My only small advice would be just to embrace and be forthcoming to whatever circumstances are, be it London or be it Blackpool. I think people are people. You just have to know how to adjust with them, how to adapt to them, and not be difficult to adapt to those cultures, and not create a roadblock to adapt. Because the moment you create a roadblock in your own mind, you will never be successful.
What's going on, guys? Anand here. Welcome back. And for those of you tuning in for the first time, then you really have ended up in a great place. This week, I get to dive into a bit of familiarity to my own roots. I get to host a conversation with a guest who is incredibly smart, both in his IQ and EQ, and you get a real sense of that through today's conversation. To give a bit more context, as a result of his dad serving in the Air Force, it ultimately meant that Joydeep spent a large segment of his childhood studying across various different parts of India, which saw him become really good at adapting to building new relationships with people of different backgrounds very early in his life. He's since worked his way up from being a software engineer in Bangalore to a senior principal consultant in London, and now has global responsibility at HSBC. But what I really loved about this conversation was that I had the chance to dive into the perspectives Joydeep had of what role his less common upbringing had on the way he approached both people and opportunities, as well as gaining a first-hand view of what it was really like to study in India and eventually moving abroad to, as he describes it, making a home for himself in the UK. This really was an insightful conversation from start to finish, and I am truly excited that I get to share it with you. Hello, Joydeep. Thank you so much for joining me here today.
Hi, Anand. How are you doing?
I'm doing great, actually. Thank you for asking. I recall when we first connected, I could tell that there was so much depth to your backstory and so many elements that deserved uncovering. But what I really remember was just the humility in your demeanor and the way you brought yourself across. And there's also this real personal sentiment for me from this conversation. For those who know me or have listened to season one, I'm Indian by ethnicity, so my grandparents are born there.
Okay.
But because my parents are born in Africa and I was born in London, I'm quite removed from what the traditions and the way of life would have been growing up in India. So I feel like there's a lot that I will be able to learn from this conversation with you. And that's why I'm, you know, almost extra excited to dive into this. So yeah, really over to you. And I'd love to hear a bit more about what it was like to grow up there.
Sure. Thanks so much for having me, firstly, Anna. It's a great opportunity to speak to you and also share some of my personal experience, a life's journey, you can say, because some of the questions that you're looking to ask also takes you back throughout your life, childhood. I grew up in India and I was born and raised there until I migrated abroad for work. My father was in the armed forces. He was part of the Indian Air Force back in India. And fortunately, thanks to his profession, I got an opportunity to travel, to live all over India. So the way it works is if you're in armed forces, you get postings. It's across different cities, different towns every 2-3 years. So that allowed me to travel north, south, east, west of the country, learn different languages, learn different cultures, develop a taste for different food across. And India is a huge country, as you may be aware.
Oh, absolutely.
And coming from that kind of a childhood allowed that cultural mix to understand how it works in the north versus south versus east versus west. And not everybody gets that option or that kind of upbringing when you're growing up as a child. But I think people from that armed forces background, and you will see a lot of success stories in media also, when there are kids coming from armed forces background, they get a different sense of how to, you know, live in their life, because they have lived across different cultures, across different backgrounds, and they can relate to people, they can work with people, they can talk to people from different cultures too. So for me, it was about staying, living, studying in different schools. I've probably studied in 10 odd schools.
Oh, wow.
Because every 2-3 years, like I was saying, that I used to keep shifting. And then I did my high school, which is, I think, equivalent to A-levels in the UK.
So going back to when you were in Delhi, this school that you were studying in, if I've got this right, it wasn't just a normal school. It was an Air Force school.
Yes, that's right. So what happens in armed forces is every armed forces like Air Force, Army, Navy, for their families of people who work with them, they have their own schooling as well. So I used to be in Air Force School. I used to also be in a lot of government schools while I was young, while I was studying. And that kind of gives you even more experience, because in those Air Force schools, people from different cultures and backgrounds come and study, of those who are, you know, coming and living in that particular campus for those couple of years. So you mix from people from Delhi, you mix from people from South India, you mix from people from all different backgrounds. So as children, you get that opportunity to mix and match from the from you know, families from different backgrounds.
And so I'd love to know, what was that like? How did it compare to, say, a normal education system? And also, you know, going back, what impact do you think that this kind of curriculum or system had on your mindset?
Yes, I think the normal education system would be where, you know, for someone like you, if you are born and raised in a typical city like, say, a Mumbai or a Calcutta, and you are born and raised in Mumbai, you've studied throughout your childhood in Mumbai, so you may not be mingling or mixing with a lot of other students, a lot of other cultures from different cities. And the beauty of India is every town in India has a different vibe to it. The culture of Delhi is completely different from culture of Mumbai. So as a child, I was fortunate to get that back, sort of intermixing with different cultures, different people. And I think I wouldn't have had that opportunity had it not been for my father. And when I look back and I see a lot of people in today's times also, they're very comfortable in their own culture. So Gujaratis may only be speaking to Gujaratis. They may not be able to speak to, you know, people from different sector, different culture. Whereas Punjabis may be only comfortable speaking to Punjabis. Whereas for someone like me, I can speak to all different cultures because that's how I grew up. And I find that as a something I was quite fortunate with. And even in my at work or even in my side hustle with the business, I have that opportunity that I can speak to different people from different cultures, can relate to them, whether it's a person from this city or from that city, from different backgrounds. And I think that's the opportunity that I got because of my childhood. So I'm quite grateful that I came from that background.
Yeah, it really is fascinating to hear, you know, the kind of practical benefits that you can directly link to coming through that kind of schooling system and upbringing. And also from my perception, I imagine giving the type of school that it was, that quite a central part in all of it would have been implementing discipline.
Yes.
Was that the case?
Oh, yes. I think armed forces, not just being Air Force, but Army, I think there's a core central system of being disciplined, because your fathers and your mothers who are working for the armed forces are also themselves expected to be disciplined. You know, they are expected to follow that regime as part of the armed forces lifestyle. So for case being example being, we were not allowed to leave our homes until our shoes are polished. So that was a very interesting fact. And my dad used to insist on that fact, because if I'm going to the school or whether he is also going out, the shoes will have to be polished, because that's how his training was. And he would like to influence that on us.
Yeah, that's amazing.
I don't do that right now. I've probably lost that at this point of time. But yes, when we used to work even here, you always like to look at your shoes and say, it doesn't look very polished. So shall we just quickly apply a coat of polish before we head out to work? But that has come from the fact that even in childhood, we were like that. Discipline was something which obviously my mom and dad were very strongly focused on, because it comes from their profession. So my dad used to always keep us on our toes with regards to, you know, if you're going out, say as a teenager, you have to be back home at a certain period of time. And that cutoff was very strict, because it was part of the disciplined lifestyle and their mindset, which allows you also to get that discipline as well. You have to wake up at a certain time, you have to sleep at a certain time. It may sound a bit regimental, but I think that also helps you develop good habits as well. And this is me going back, like I'm born in 80s, so I may sound a bit old, but I think that kind of helps you form a lifestyle and a pattern which you still do carry. And even now, I probably carry that in some of the other ways in my day-to-day lifestyle. So yeah, I've learned my morals and values of life thanks to my childhood.
Yeah, it's really great to hear that. And, you know, if I take a look at my own life, for example, something that I've really been working on and thinking about over the last few years is that as you grow older and the responsibilities increase and, you know, you start having more goals and certain things that you want to achieve, not like I didn't have these when I was younger, but I think I realize more and more now the benefit of having routines and disciplines in place, you know, to be able to form those habits. And for sure, you know, it's difficult to stick to them sometimes. And a lot of that is the idea of having to shake off bad old habits. So I really appreciate that you view that kind of structure and regimented way of life that you went through your upbringing and seen the kind of benefit that it has on you.
Of course, yeah, that's right.
And just on that, could you recall any fond memories or stories of examples of this, either in your schooling or personal life while growing up?
I think one of the things that I always also really fondly look back is being in armed forces campuses lifestyle and being in an education system that I was. It allowed me to play a lot of sports. And that's the beauty of armed forces lifestyle, that you get access to all kinds of sporting facilities around you. And I think sports teaches also a lot of good things in your life. It teaches you how to be focused. It teaches you how to work as a team player. It teaches you how to mix with other players and, you know, work with other players and other kids and other, you know, peers in your group. And I think that's something that I certainly have carried forward even as of today. What probably it may not do good, and I've maybe missed that aspect, is you don't carry long-term friends because you're shifting every 2-3 years. So you're moving from one town to the other, you're moving from one city to the other every couple of years. And I always feel that when I look at other people around me, where they, you know, if maybe you are also an example where you may have childhood friends even carrying forward till now. I probably don't have that because my childhood friends always used to vary and always used to differ every few years. So I think that in hindsight is something which I kind of feel a bit lost out on. But I've kind of developed good friends and I've had long-term friendship in my adulthood after I started working, because then you are more based at one particular place in a private establishment, whereas in an armed forces establishment, since you kept moving every time, you lose out on that particular aspect that you don't have long-term childhood friends. And sometimes long-term childhood friends, they stay more closer to you than your adult friends.
It's a really interesting point that you just brought up. And in a conversation I was having with another guest, we were discussing how when you become used to moving home or a lot of traveling and moving around, you almost become adept and more able to form stronger bonds and relationships with people that you maybe haven't known for as long. So it's almost the idea of quality over quantity and being able to view relationships and friendships in that way, which I think is a definite advantage. But also, on the flip side, do you think that knowing that you would be moving around and moving again from a location that you'd settled in, do you think that almost restricted you or put up a barrier preventing you from growing close to people, knowing that you'd be moving again within the next few months?
I think that as a child, you're far too innocent to have those kind of feelings. I think sometimes you do want to have more people around you. And also maybe it's also a personality thing that I may come across as a people's person. So I also do like to mingle around a lot of people, even in today's times. And even as a child, you always feel excited to have new friends. Yes, it was sometimes a bit unfortunate that you felt that, oh, hang on, I've just made good friends with this guy. And then in two or three years' time, you have to leave that person and go somewhere else and start all over again. So it could be challenging. It could be something you feel quite, you know, distraughtful. But hey, that was what my lifestyle was, and that's what was given to me thanks to my father's profession. So I had to go with it.
You also mentioned that you played a lot of sports.
Yes.
Was that something that was actively encouraged by your parents, or did it come from, you know, a school-led initiative, or was it just personal interest?
Both. My dad used to be a sports player too. He used to play football, he used to play hockey, and he always encouraged us to play. And since childhood, I've always been into sports a lot. I used to play until university time, and after that, when you start working, probably I've reduced it a bit. But I still do follow, I still do watch. I watch a lot of sports on TV. And I'm actually itching for my son to grow up so that I could start maybe take him to sports grounds and develop that passion back again through him. So I've always, I'm a big sports fan, and I think sports is a great cultural exposure to kids to learn a lot about life and how to, you know, play with others and develop that mindset of harmony, of teamwork, of togetherness, rather than just sole contribution or single mindset. So I think sports is great. I always encourage people to go play, to play in team sports, especially not just solo sports, because you learn a lot.
And I'm sure you may have thought about this already, but do you have a preference on what sport you would want your son to grow up playing or watching?
Actually, not a, no preference, because you can't enforce anything on a child. I used to play most of the outdoor sports. I played cricket, football, hockey. I used to do a lot of swimming. So I never used to be like, okay, or my father never used to tell me like, no, you only have to play cricket, coming from India, as you can imagine. I played a lot of cricket, but also I played a lot of football, because I used to be participating in a lot of football teams and university teams and things like that. And still love enjoying watching football on TV. So, yeah, I mean, I do want my son to play football, definitely in the UK. Otherwise, I think it's like a bit of a miss out if you don't play football in the UK. But if he wants to end up playing hockey at the end, I would love that, because I think hockey is a great sport to play. It's a very tough and very competitive sport, and I think something like that would be great for every child.
Yeah, I think when the child is young, it's nice to give them the options to explore different avenues and different types of sports. And I'm sure that there'll be people who have very differing views on this. But one story I always remember is around Andre Agassi. And I think in his autobiography, he talks about how he always hated tennis throughout his career. And he was always trying to persuade people of this, which, you know, sometimes you think is hard to imagine given how many things he won. But I think at a young age, his father, who was an Olympian, always had this desire of having one of his three sons become a tennis player. And I think he chose Andre, or knew that Andre Agassi had the most natural gift. But I think from a very young age, he tied, I believe it was paddling pads, to Andre Agassi's wrists. And when Andre turned six, his dad would make him hit 2,500 balls a day, so that it would work out at hitting a million tennis balls a year. So, you know, that kind of enforcement, obviously it turned him into a superstar. But on the flip side, it meant that he hated the sport. So, you know, there's that discussion of, was it all worth it in the end if he never found any enjoyment in it? And he's also not the only person who has this kind of story. So I think it's a, you know, it's a fascinating point that you mentioned. Again, I'm not saying there's a right and a wrong answer, but it definitely makes for an interesting discussion.
It's very interesting. I think it also depends on the parent too. Not that I'm taking any sides here, but sometimes your parents can also identify that, hey, my son or daughter has to become a sportsperson and not into more professional services, or not grow up to be into a business person. So maybe if in the young age, I've heard of stories where, let's say, famous cricketers and footballers, at a young age, they're only being asked to go and follow that passion of playing only cricket or only football, because I think the parents or their coaches must have identified that in their school time. And that talent has to be then expertise rather than going and playing different sports and losing that academic career. So I think it's a great conversation, but I think that it also has its own views. Every parent may have its own views. For me, I would probably keep my son completely flexible if he wants to become a sportsman, or whether he wants to pursue academics. Totally up to him.
Yeah, I strongly agree with that approach. But what was the situation like in India in general? And the reason I ask is because I spent 2 years in China, and I knew a few people who were teaching out there, and they would often say they would see children who were, you know, really gifted and had a passion for sports or performing arts or, you know, playing a musical instrument. But often if it was seen as something that was taking away from the priority of education,
academics,
then it would be actively discouraged. You know, it's a shame to see sometimes that, you know, some of them were really good, but it just, you know, like I say, was deprioritized. Was this kind of a similar case that you saw in India?
Yeah, I think it's probably a bit of a Asian parent mindset, I would say. Not just India, but Southeast Asia and Asia per se, where I think academics are probably given much more value than sports and entertainment for that matter. So even when I was growing, I think during my generation, it was always that you need to become either a doctor or engineer rather than a sports person. And hence, like I said just some time back, had my father been like Agassi's father, and he would have said, hey, Joydeep, you know, you need to be a cricketer only, because he sees that potential or the talent in me to be a cricketer. He would have not pushed me to pursue academic career and then become an engineer and then become what I am today. Whereas he would have said, hey, let's play cricket or let's play football 12 hours a day to get that coaching skills, to get that grooming skills, to become that sports person. But yeah, like I was saying, I'm not taking sides. So it was totally up to how my parents wanted me to grow and how they saw an ideal life or ideal path for me to grow. But there are many other parents in India who do follow, who do support their child's vision, who do support their child's interest. Otherwise, they wouldn't have been a very successful Indian cricket team, and they wouldn't have been a very successful Indian sports team in other various departments. Every parent has a different views. So like we say, no child is same, also no parent is same.
Yes, I really love how you've said that. And when I look back at my childhood, my parents always encouraged me in a lot of extracurricular activities. So swimming club, karate, tennis classes, playing the piano. But there was always this overarching focus on school and studies. So I appreciated that I did have the balance between being able to do both. But I knew that it was always the case that none of that would ever take priority over getting good grades, for example.
Sure.
And I think you're right that there's something in the Asian mindset that I noticed even amongst my friends that was quite common. And without this turning into a bit of a parenting 101, even though it can be seen quite common in that culture, I think you're right. It can't be categorized as that's how it is for everyone.
Yeah, I think that's definitely could be a bit of an Asian parents' mindset. But I think times are changing. I have seen a lot of parents in the last few years who have given their child encouragement to go and pursue their passion, to go and pursue their skill, if it's sports or if it's fine arts or if it's entertainment or any other areas, and not just be a doctor or an engineer. So it totally depends. Within my network as well, we've got artists, we've got, you know, people who have been pursuing fine arts as a passion for last 20 years. And that probably would have only been possible if their parents would have allowed them to be. So yeah, times are changing. I think in the Western world, it is much more obvious you see around you, because you see sports in your day-to-day life across every, you know, parts of your life when you switch on the TV or when you go out into a park or somewhere. Whereas in India, sometimes you don't see that much. But again, like I said, it's changing. So hopefully in the next few years, you will see more sportsmen or more quality sports individuals coming out of Asian countries like India. And I think that would be good. That would also be a testament to how parents' mindset is. But it will take time. It won't happen in a year or two. It will probably take some generations for that to change.
Absolutely. And I think alongside the influence of globalization and, you know, the kind of rise of middle class and facilities in general, there's a lot more significance placed.
Yeah.
And I think that the IPL could be the highest paying sports league in the world now, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah. And it's probably because all those young talent which is coming out of IPL are being encouraged by their parents, like I was saying, to go and pursue their passion for cricket. So if 19-year-olds can nowadays become a millionaire for start because of their participation in the IPL, is because one of the parents would have encouraged them to go through the ranks and go through the coaches, go through the academies, to go and, you know, perform and to go and play for their passion. And hence, when they have performed at an international stage, they have been picked up for performing more at an international stage with their franchises and with their, you know, teams. So I think it's a great example. IPL is actually a great example for people, for young kids. And I'm sure you'll see more and more young talent coming, not just in India, but everywhere, even in the UK for that matter. I think Rashford is a classic example. Had Rashford's mum not allowed him to go and express his footballing skills, we wouldn't have had a Marcus Rashford in the society. So it's in every country, it's in every society. But I think in Asian society, it is lesser. But hopefully that will change in the next few generations.
Yes, for sure. And the way that some of the Asian nations are developing, you know, especially the likes of China and India, this probably is the time where sort of the biggest changes are coming. And before we move on, the final question on this, who is your IPL team?
Kolkata. I come from Kolkata. My parents are from Kolkata, so I will always support Kolkata Knight Riders first.
Okay, fair enough.
And also I like Shah Rukh Khan.
Oh, really? I think I'm more of an Amir Khan fan. But moving on, so you mentioned that you went on to study engineering.
Yes.
How did that come around?
Yeah, so since parents were insisting on following an academic career, I started applying for engineering courses. It's something called as entrance exams back in India, where for engineering courses, you need to give entrance exams to different universities, to different colleges, to different states as well. And I got myself enrolled in an entrance exam in a university in Bangalore, which is south of the India. And Bangalore in those days was a booming city for information technology careers. Most of the engineering jobs were created out of Bangalore. So most of the parents during my generation were keen for their kids to go and actually study in Bangalore too, which is what I did. I went to Bangalore in 2001 for my engineering, and I did a 4 years engineering degree and came out of engineering and got a job to start with. And that was a good experience because Bangalore was a completely different culture to work and live in. There's a completely different language altogether. People that back in those years didn't used to speak the official language of India, which is Hindi, a lot, or even English. They were more comfortable speaking the local dialects. So we had to kind of navigate our way through the local cultures and make ourselves not just successful academically, but also professionally when we all came out. And also to live in a city, to mingle in a city, we had to, be accustomed, or we have to place ourselves within that local culture of people around, local mindset of people around. So it was interesting times. It's like someone from London going and living in Edinburgh. It sometimes can be quite different because Edinburgh has its own vibe different than London. And you have to go and adjust to the vibe in Edinburgh. Although the dialect is probably similar, but at least the culture can be slightly different. Whereas in India, the language is different.
Well, you say that, but even though we're from the same country and speak the same language, there definitely are times when it can be difficult to understand them as well.
Very difficult.
And maybe
they say
the same for us, I don't know.
Yes, whereas in India, it's like a completely different language altogether. It's nothing related to Hindi, which is the official, which is at least the officially widely spoken language in India, if not the official language of India. I think when we started studying there, it was quite interesting and challenging for us to absorb and get involved in the local culture. But we finished our degree, we finished our bachelor's of engineering, and I started working. I worked as an information technology software engineer to start with. And that was how I started my career back in 2006.
So just to touch on your life at university, how did you go about integrating and socializing with people? Was there a lot of encouragement or any emphasis placed on, societies and clubs and getting involved in that way?
Yes, I think one good aspect of university was also the fact that you get an opportunity to both participate in sports as well and also social curricular festivals as well. Sometimes you have to pursue your own passion. So what I used to do was our university didn't have a football team actually when I went and joined, and I sort of started a football team of ours with a couple of our mates in the university, and we used to play football regularly, and that's how our university had a football team at the end of my 4 years journey. And then we used to also participate in social curricular activities. We used to do cultural festivals, we used to do student interactive festivals, and all of that used to happen as part of the university's keeping their interests in mind. But it was more of students going and participating, and we used to go have our own say of how we can organize and take all those initiatives. So it was not just about studies. In the evenings after you're done with academics, you used to go and play football or cricket for an hour or so every evening. And we used to mingle together, we used to hang out together. So it's very different how you study back in India versus how you study in the West. I think here you are more sort of thinking of, yes, you do hear about Oxford and Cambridge, but not every university I've heard has a very popular sports team, whereas back in India, there's a lot of competition between universities for their sporting teams too. So that's something very exciting. And my college also used to compete in cricket, and used to compete in inter-college sports meets and cultural meets. So, and we used to participate in all that.
So that's a really fascinating point to me that you've just raised there, because it almost feels like they've adopted much more of that American college model where, say basketball is almost as big, if not bigger, at college level than it is at the professional level.
Absolutely, yeah.
Would you say it was more similar to that?
Actually, a good point. Yeah, you've hit a right note, because I think it probably come from the American culture that we used to also have like football meets, and it was very competitive. Cricket meets, very, very competitive. And I think that probably resonates with the American style, where, you know, they play a lot of, like you say, basketball, their own American football as well. And athletics is very popular in American schools and colleges. I don't think in India athletics is that popular, but it is still getting popularity day by day. Whereas football and cricket definitely has a lot of prominence, and also social festivals. There's to be huge competition between colleges for so arts and social festivals.
Wow, that's actually given me a lot more insight into what the schooling and even social system is really like there. I think it's sometimes easy to forget that some of the best universities in the world are in India. And I really wouldn't be surprised if we start seeing India come a lot more into the global sort of radar when it comes to certain sports. So definitely something to look out for. And so moving on to, how did your eventual move away from India come around?
So I started working, like I said, in Bangalore. I worked there for a few years before I moved abroad. So my first stint abroad was in Canada. I moved to Canada for a year in Toronto as part of my career, as part of my work experience. And I worked in Toronto for a multinational organization. It was a big tier one of the banks out there. And Canada is a fantastic country, beautiful country to work, beautiful country to live, although extremely cold. So you don't want to be there in winters. But outside winters, it's a beautiful country. The people are great. Toronto is an amazing multicultural country to city to also live in. And I got married pretty young compared to today's times. And she was working too. So both me and my wife, we moved to Canada for a bit. Then we came back to India once my year-long stint got over. And then we again came out and moved to UK. So we moved to UK in 2011. And ever since then, we have been in the UK.
And so how did the decision to specifically go to Canada come about?
It was more work-driven, not personal decision. And I said, yes. I said, yeah, sure. It's always good to get some international exposure. And that was a fantastic exposure for someone coming out of India. So I think I'm very grateful for that opportunity.
Right. And was it common for, you know, within your network or social circle, this idea of moving abroad?
Yeah, I think that's part of the outsourcing boom that you may have heard from 2000, Y2K movement, where a lot of jobs started getting outsourced from the Western world to the Asian subcontinent. And people were kind of supporting a lot of the international clients, international customers out of Asia, but also getting an opportunity to also travel internationally as well, as part of transition, as part of, you know, working on client sites rather than just based out of India. So that's whole onward toward movement of labor, of migrants, of workers from different countries to different countries is actually part and parcel of today's international economy. And I think that's great for somebody who may be out of working out of an office in Bangalore or working out of an office in Singapore or in Vietnam. If given an opportunity to go and work in their head offices are based out of New York City or from London and get that exposure, and I think get that confidence, and then maybe as a migrant settle down and, you know, live with their family for forever. And that was probably the opportunity that was offered. And I think I took it with both hands, and here we are today after almost 10 years in London that I'm speaking to you as well.
See, so that's actually very eye-opening for me as well. And it doesn't come to a huge surprise, but just to hear it firsthand that, you know, you hear a lot of how there's been globalization and a move of jobs away from developed markets like the Western economies to places like India and now Southeast Asia. But really, this also opened the doors for the skills and talent from places like India to be able to move abroad to these more developed markets
and
contribute to those economies.
And I see a lot of expats who are now, say, from the UK. They live in Dubai, they live in Singapore, they live in Australia. And because that's how the global economy works. Yes, you may end up having more jobs outsourced or offshored from one country from a high cost location to a lower cost location like in Asia. But you also have sometimes the other way around, where jobs from a low-cost country, let's say a Singapore or a Vietnam, may need somebody with a higher skill set from someone from New York or from someone from London. And if you're interested, you can go and apply and you can go and settle there. And I think it's how capitalism works, unfortunately, that you will always look to reduce cost and save more money. So you will end up identifying lower-cost destinations, lower-cost locations where employment is probably much more economical compared to salaries based out of London and New York. But also it gives you an opportunity for somebody from those countries, like myself, who was there, to come abroad and work and live in a society or in a country like England. And it wouldn't have been possible if capitalism or if the global economy wouldn't have existed like it does today.
Did you face any hurdles or restrictions, you know, either from family or even any other sources in the planning and the decision to permanently move abroad?
No, actually, my parents were very, very happy. I think that's one thing which obviously Asian parents would always be happy if their kids want to, you know, go travel abroad or travel and live abroad. Sometimes people don't. My parents were fortunately very happy about it. And I think me and my wife, we both have a very global mindset in that way, very forthcoming. And I think so are our parents equally. And I think, again, that's going back to our culture and going back to our upbringing with our parents.
Yeah, it's great to hear. And, you know, maybe this is more of a personal opinion or perspective, but there's sometimes that very protectionist mindset over children by, well, especially Asian parents. And, you know, the kind of old joke of, you only move out from your home once you're married. Whereas, say, in, you know, somewhere like England, where it's like, okay, you're 18, out the door you go. But jokes aside, it's good to see that there was this mindset of what's best for the child is also what we will support.
And that's probably a very interesting point, because I don't know how it is probably for kids who are born and raised in the UK. If tomorrow somebody from the UK or from England gets an opportunity to go and work back in India or in Singapore or any of the expat location, would your parents be equally forthcoming to allow you to go and settle there or to go and work there for a long number of years? And I haven't seen that many examples happening. But whereas on the other side, people from India and their parents and our parents have always been very forthcoming that, yes, if there is an opportunity, why don't you go? And I think that's a quite interesting topic. I'm sure you would like to explore in your podcast.
Yeah, it's a very good question. And you draw on a very insightful point. I mean, for me, for example, I did have the fortune that I got to move to Shanghai for work. And, you know, there was still this mindset of, I think it came down to more that it was being China and it was more the fear of the unknown. So different to somewhere like Australia or even to Singapore or Hong Kong, for me, it was a draw. It made me more attracted to it being a place that was upcoming, but also not as common as some of the other places that were well known for people to go to for work. So I was attracted by it. But, you know, I can see where there's that, we are happy for you to go and explore and kind of broaden your horizons under the kind of premise that you will be returning.
Yeah, and I think it's culture to culture. We have probably made England our home over the last 10 years. Our parents have accepted that. And I think they're happy with the fact that at least their kids have a good lifestyle, they have a good job, they have a good settled career, whether be it in India, whether be it in the UK. I think my parents are happy with it. Obviously, they would love it if I would have been with them back in India. But I think they're also happy about the fact that we've got a good stable lifestyle also now in England.
That's great to hear. So you said you were in Canada for a year and then eventually you moved on to moving to London. How was that in terms of, you know, either differences in integrating into London versus your first experience? And do you think that it really helped that you'd already done that move to Canada? Do you think that helped you with settling into London?
I think you are right that the experience in Canada definitely did make that process a lot more comfortable. But I would also probably say that London is an amazing multicultural city. Probably London and New York are at the top from being multicultural in its true sense, where you have the moment you step out of Heathrow, there are pockets in London where you feel that you're actually back in Asia. You don't feel that you're in the UK. And that gives you the warmth and that gives you the comfort to settle down and live in the country. And I have probably, in the last 10 years, never had any issues with regards to living or staying. Maybe also because of the fact that when I was young, like I was telling you, I was moving from one city to other, one location to other with my father's profession. And that probably was always in my genes, that when I moved to a new city like London, it did not take me too long to settle in, because it was about the job, it was also about getting in, and it was also about meeting people. You have fellow people from India, from fellow Asians living in London, with whom you start interacting, and they help you to, you know, settle down, they help you to navigate the society and the system around you in London. Yeah, it's been 10 years and I've probably been fortunate that I've never had any challenges or any issues. Apart from the fact that the weather was always a key factor, a lot of people do struggle when they come to the UK due to the weather factor. But I'm okay. Sometimes you do miss the sun. Sometimes you do miss going out. Sometimes you do miss sunny climate and warm weather around you. But I think that the rule of nature is you accept it is what it is, and you move on with it.
Yeah, that's a powerful point. I love that. And when you first arrived, did you feel that you integrated straight in and you found that all right? Or was there a period where you may have felt like a bit of an outsider, especially when interacting with people who were not other people from abroad, say?
Maybe in the profession that I was in, banking, I don't think there is much of a challenge to interact with other cultures and with people who are traditionally English versus Asians. Whereas, I don't know, maybe in some other industries, maybe in public sector or in utilities, where it's probably not as multicultural or multi-ethnicity of people being involved. If you go into a bank or into an office of any of these banks in Canary Wharf or in the city, you'll immediately see people from different color, from different background, from different ethnicity, from different cultures working on the same floor, which gives you that reality check that it's not just people from one particular culture, one particular background, and you can immediately relate and settle in. So I would say banking has been a great facilitator to settle in that way. Had I been in a different sector, I don't know what would have happened. But I think personally, and again, that's probably back to the personality as well, I have never felt that I have had any issues to settle in, and I've never thought that as a blocker in my mind. I've always gone and accepted and being very forthcoming about socializing and mixing with cultures and people in different cities and in different countries or in different areas. And same in London, when I came here, that was my first thing, to go and mix with the local crowd, go and mix with people here, so that you get more comfortable both at yourself and you make them also comfortable having someone like me who's come from outside.
And like you say, given the childhood and upbringing that you had, especially the school you went to, you know, kind of being able to mix with so many different backgrounds, even just across India, really probably contributed and helped you to be able to integrate,
yes,
with new societies and people of different backgrounds, yes, and beliefs and tastes.
Yes, I think that was a key factor, key contributor. I've heard a lot of my own friends and people in my own circle who have struggled after moving into a new country like the UK. They've had homesickness, they have had a lot of challenges to adapt to the weather, to adapt to the food, to adapt to the lifestyle. Whereas, thankfully, someone like me never had that kind of an issue. We've always been quite fortunate. We've always been quite adaptable of sorts in whatever life has given us. And just move on with a positive mindset, really.
And what advice would you give to someone who may not have had that same exposure to so many different types of characters and backgrounds in, you know, their early upbringing? What advice would you give them, not even just if they were coming from India, but if they were moving from their home country to somewhere abroad?
I think the main key advice would be very, very positive and embrace whatever gives you, whatever life is giving you. A lot of my friends probably are not as fortunate when they came to UK to live in London. They probably moved to some of these tier 2, tier 3 cities in the UK, and that's where they probably felt a bit more difficult to settle in into a country, whereas London, being much more multicultural, has that benefit that you don't feel cut off. Had my first experience of moving into UK would have been, say, in a city like Hull or Sheffield or or Blackpool. No offense to those cities, no insult to those cities, but it's different. It's not as multi-ethnic, multicultural, as global in its vibe. My only small advice would be just to embrace and be forthcoming to whatever circumstances are, be it London or be it Blackpool. I think people are people. You just have to know how to adjust with them, how to adapt to them, and not be difficult to adapt to those cultures and not create a roadblock to adapt. Because the moment you create a roadblock in your own mind, you will never be successful. You just have to go out with open arms and embrace. And I love it. I love the fact that one of my first colleagues whom I used to sit around was actually from Scotland back in 2011. And initially, yes, I did struggle to understand his language because of his accent. But he made me very comfortable to speak a bit slowly. And he said, hey, any help you need, you know, come and talk to me. And then he introduced me to a lot of other colleagues and who became very friendly. And you just have to pick up some of these people when you start your journey new, that identify some of these friendly people. And people here generally are very friendly. That's what I really like about England. And I think that's probably a testament to the fact that it's such a multicultural country. It's a country where migrants are always coming in and out, and they're always welcome, rather than many countries where migrants are probably not as welcome as England. So, yeah, I think I've been quite fortunate that way.
I love that. And I love how you said people are people. And it's often the roadblock in your own head that you need to clear, and not the roadblocks externally around you. And that's, once you've cleared that, then you're able to connect a lot better with the people
absolutely
around you.
Absolutely.
So, you know, I really love what you said there. And so, you know, looking at your career, you've worked at some top companies and, you know, at least on paper, a very successful kind of journey through that career. Talk me through that. Was this always, as you saw it, somewhere where the opportunities were there and presented themselves? Or do you feel you had to work a bit harder than, say, an equivalent peer?
I think as part of the settling in period, when you come to a country like UK, whenever I have spoken to any of my friends who have also come to UK recently, I've always told them that first 3-4 years of your journey in UK or in any new country is always the hardest. You have to work more harder than you have probably in the past, because you are trying to create that impression on not just your colleagues, your peers, your superiors, but also in and around you, because you're new. You're not known. You've not proven at all, and you have to earn that stripes. So I would say be prepared to work extra hard those first 3-4 years, and then it gets much more easier. But yeah, I have also faced difficult circumstances in the last 10 years. There have been work challenges, there have been cost challenges, there have been business challenges. This last 1 year, 1.5 years, probably has been the toughest I have seen in my career, because there have been many, many economic issues. There are many, many funding issues at institutions like bank, especially in the banking sector, because of which there is a lot of restructuring happening. There's a lot of, you know, redundancies that are happening. And I think this 1 year has probably taught a lot of things to different people. To me, it has taught that I need to also start thinking about having plan B in life. And that's something that I have started exploring over the last 18 months, that always have a plan A in life, but also have a plan B in life if at all plan A is at risk. So explore the path of entrepreneurship, explore the path of setting up a business if you are interested, explore the part of following an interest or a passion that you are keen for. And that's something that I've been working on in the last 1 year to 18 months.
Yeah, I love that. And it's definitely a good point. You know, when you're entering a new environment, you naturally have to go through that phase of proving yourself. And I think it applies in all situations. You know, when you're immersing yourself in a new career, new social circle, new country, there's almost that, you know, you are new. So you have to go through that period of validating your worth to people.
Yeah, especially if you're coming to a new country, it's even more. And I feel sorry for someone who may have probably moved into UK, say, in 2020, because things are so uncertain, and especially in COVID times, compared to someone like us who have been settled here for a number of times. God knows what's been happening with them. But all you can do is just remain positive, stay positive, and work hard, really, and try to explore avenues, try to explore networking, try to explore how you can work around with different people, how you can work around with, and identify friends, identify who you know around, so that you can seek help. And I think one of the things that I have learned here is always be ready to ask questions and seek help, because there are always people who will help you. If you think you don't want to do that, I think it's only going to make your life more difficult. And you learn from that, and then you end up going and, you know, replicating what they have done. So you will never have all the answers in a new country. So you have to just, you know, figure out who you can ask, rely on some of your friends and some of your, you know, peers who have been here before you, and seek their opinion, seek their feedbacks. And only then you can learn and, you know, move on, really.
Yeah, it's very well said. And, you know, a motive that I live by. I mean, I say motive, it's the ABC of always be curious. And I think it's something that I've always had in part, but especially after living abroad and changing jobs and having to adapt to new environments, I feel that's been heightened. And it's also one of the reasons that led me to start this podcast. You know, the idea of speaking to people like yourself from certain backgrounds and seeing how your journey and your mindset and your character has all evolved and how it's helped you to get you to where you are. Which brings me to the entrepreneurial side hustle that you said you're working on building out. I'd love to know more about what exactly that is.
Sure. So around 18 months back, after I became a father, when we had our first child, I think that's probably sort of sparked a bit of an, you know, the entrepreneurial journey and the business mindset in me. And I've probably always enjoyed being sort of an organizer and a planner of sorts in life, be it a party planner or a event organizer or an event manager, because I used to do all that back in my university time. And I said, let me try exploring the same thing out here. So what I did was I started setting up an events organization or an events management company. And we started doing community festivals in our area, especially towards East London. And we started with Asian festivals. We started with multi-community festivals like New Year's parties, Colour Play Festival, Diwali, the Festival of Lights, and started exploring how we can also then take it forward to private events like birthdays and baby showers and special occasions and things like that. So I did probably 4 big events before lockdown, because obviously I started in 2019 and lockdown happened 2020 March. The last event that I did was the Colour Play Festival, the holy event, which we call it, 2 weeks before lockdown in March. And we had around 650 people for that particular occasion. So that was me as a sole entrepreneur, as a sole trader, sole practitioner. I started that whole events business, and I kind of, you know, had these couple of occasions to remember. And once lockdown happened, I thought that, what do I do to keep the name in the market growing? Because I've spent that much effort to grow the business, to grow the branding, to grow the name in the market. Lockdown is going to just stop everything. And I have to probably start all over again after lockdown. So I started doing things online. I formed something called as a virtual platform for people like me to network and people like me to come and interact together, called the EEL Association. What does EEL stands for is Entrepreneurship, Entertainment, and Lifestyle, which is quite different than many other groups that you will hear or many other networks you will hear in online. And it's actually about giving an opportunity to entrepreneurs and businesses to come and, you know, showcase and express their work, because things are all online. I've been told that it's a safe community, it's a safe association for people, and there are lots of ladies as well who come and, you know, showcase their work, who come and tell us about their what the business is. So that's about the business entrepreneurship. And I also associated E with also empowerment, because a lot of times when people start their journey new as a business, as an entrepreneur, they don't know where to go. They don't know how to navigate the system around them. And I can probably give them that platform to go and, you know, socialize, to go and network with other businesses, other entrepreneurs, and be known in the market and be known in the community. So that was what one E stood for. Then the second E was for entertainment, to keep the party atmosphere going, to keep the, you know, the whole events business going from my own side. And we started doing virtual events. We did a virtual Diwali. We did a virtual New Year's Eve. The virtual Diwali was also recognized in the BBC. There's an article on BBC around virtual Diwali celebrations where I got recognized because of the work that we were doing in the association. And we'll be probably carrying on the same for another few months before, you know, we can start doing things in person. So that E of entertainment is a very strong factor. And lastly, the L of EEL stands for lifestyle, where we try to do some talk shows like what you are doing with me. But we do that in a way where we pick up a theme. And one of the themes we identified was called as the Women of EEL. And we pick up topics and themes around related to everyday life of women, the last topic we had was around postnatal depression. We spoke about how women have overcome divorce and what was their journey. You've spoken about that, you know, being a mom guilt factor, body shaming. Some of these topics have been dealt with over the last few months. And every month we have this roundtable discussion on that particular networking group. So I'm very proud of what we have created. We've got around 6,500 people right now in that particular association. And we are growing. We want to keep having new people, new members. And if someone like you want to come and, you know, set up a podcast and to come and, you know, explore your avenues to come and pursue your passion, everyone's welcome to do that. And it's for the community. It's for people to make the most of. It's not a monetized or an incentivized Facebook group where we are trying to make any money from any of that. It's all about going and helping and doing service to the people. So that's been my latest last couple of, you know, hustles that I'm quite passionate of. And hopefully once things starts going back to normal, when we can start doing some physical events, you will hear from me more and more that I will be exploring more physical events, parties, entertainment, festivals, and things like that. Hopefully, one day we can do a music festival as well. I would love to do that. So we'll see how it goes, step by step, one step at a time.
Yeah, I'm sure you will. And, you know, looking at what you've already been able to achieve with it in the last 18 months is such a great accomplishment. And, you know, another thing I notice is there's a lot more of this blurring between the traditional corporate world and this more entrepreneurial mindset of companies. You know, some of the biggest companies are implementing more of this flexible working style and more initiatives around people taking this entrepreneurial approach. And, you know, even for you, someone who's, you know, successfully very well climbed his way up the ladder through this corporate world, but is branching out into this entrepreneurial space, it just shows a great example of how these two worlds are very much overlapping and coming together.
Yeah, it is tricky because I don't come from a business background. None of my parents had any businesses of their own. So I have to develop that as a mindset myself. And it is very difficult sometimes when you don't come from a business background to actually develop that business mindset. And that's probably what I have been exploring over the last 18 months, how to switch over from services to an entrepreneur mindset. It's a small initiative, not to rush into. I'm not running against a clock to go and make this business as a big full-time job per se. But who knows, a few years down the line, I might stop banking and I might just become a full-time event organizer or a event planner of sorts. So that's something which is there in my horizon, but obviously you need capital and equity for pursuing something like that. So taking it slowly.
That's amazing. And I wish you the best of luck with it. So just one final question on that. Who exactly is this aimed for? I mean, I know you said entrepreneurs, but, you know, does it suit a particular background or person with a particular type of interest?
And that's a beauty because it is for everyone. We go and say that people from all different backgrounds and religions and communities and faiths can join. It's not an Asian members club or it's not an Asian association or something. We've got members who are local English people. We've got members who come from a different religion and from a different culture as well. And idea is to create it as a hub, as a sort of an, it's a proper association, and an association is only formed of members from different backgrounds. And a hub is something that I like to call because it can be anything and everything you can think of across those three areas that I mentioned. And those three areas will always remain the focal point of that particular association. So it's entrepreneurship, entertainment, and lifestyle. And I think we want to do this more in physical aspect, where tomorrow if I have to go and do, say, an event in Birmingham or Leicester, that will give me that local visibility and people will then understand, oh, hang on, what is this EL association?
Yeah, I love that. It's great. And how do people connect or find out more if they want to?
So you have to go to Facebook or to Instagram. I'm on both the platforms. I did join Clubhouse as well. I'm struggling to make the most of Clubhouse because it is very, very time consuming. But my two main mediums are Facebook and Instagram. You have to go and search for EEL Association on Facebook and also EEL Professional Community on Instagram. And you will see more about who we are and what we are.
Incredible stuff. And, you know, you're not the first one to, and probably not the last one to say that about Clubhouse.
Yeah.
And I feel, you know, we're in quite an early stage still. So there's definitely ways to kind of make the most of it.
Yeah, let's see. I think there are perks and benefits of every platform. Every platform. I quite like this Riverside FM tool as well. There is Zoom, there is Riverside, there are many other. Every platform has its uniqueness. Every platform has its values. But I'm sure there are multinationals who are looking to merge all of them into one umbrella, like what Facebook, WhatsApp, Instagram is. Tomorrow, I feel something like Clubhouse will also be merged into something like an Instagram or like a Facebook, and who knows what it's going to look like.
For sure, let's see. Well, it's been excellent. Thank you for sharing everything that you have. And just before we move on to the quickfire final five, is there anything else that you feel we haven't covered that you'd like to?
No, I'm more than happy to be participating in the rapid fire. Let's go for it.
Okay, let's go. So question number one, what are you most grateful for?
I'm grateful to the fact that today I'm speaking to you and telling you about my journey over the last few years. I don't think many people have that opportunity to. So you must have recognized and seen something different in me. Hence, you invited me to have a conversation with you. So I'm very grateful for that.
Oh, wow. I definitely wasn't expecting that answer, but I greatly appreciate it. And just so the listeners know, that was not scripted or pre-planned. I didn't tell him to say any of that.
And you did not pay me also to say this.
Yeah. I really appreciate, because, you know, for me, it's being able to get stories like yours and the lessons you learn out there. And, you've facilitated that by sharing what you did. So thank you. And question number two, what would be your advice to a 20 or 30 year old version of yourself?
Two different age groups. I think a 30 year old definitely would be to have much better financial planning. I could have probably saved much more when I was, initially earning. And I think I enjoyed a bit too much than I should have. And had I saved more, I think, especially in the last 1 year, when you feel there is so much uncertainty in the market, especially with your job and especially with expenses, everything, you should always save for days like this. Because one thing which last 1 year has taught us is this can happen again. Pandemics are probably going to happen again and again in our lifetime, and you should just be prepared both financially, mentally, economically for that. So that would be my advice to a 30 year old. I think to the 20 year old would be to travel more and more. I've seen people in this country that they take a year gap and go travel around the world, and I was like, wow, had I done that? Why did I miss out on that? So I would say for a 20 year old, even if you are in the UK or in India or wherever in the world are, go and travel around yourself, because that will give you more exposure.
Amazing. And definitely some good advice for the current 20 and 30 year olds to be able to take some inspiration from. And question three, looking back now, if you were given the chance to do it all again and move somewhere else in the world, would you still have done it?
100%. I always say that I will be happy to move whenever there's an opportunity. And I think that should be the mindset which everyone has. Always look for greener pastures. Always look for opportunities around.
And so specifically, if it would have been somewhere different, do you know where that would have been?
I would probably look at countries like Singapore. I think Singapore has a very interesting charm to it, also because of the fact that it is very multicultural. Also because it forms the right intermediate between the Western world and the Eastern world, because there are lots of expats. And so I think Singapore is a great move. Also, if at all, I might explore Australia, because I've seen Sydney as a great place for family and lifestyle because of what it offers as a country. So I think Sydney would also be something in my bucket list if ever I have to choose again.
Oh, I mean, I fully relate. Australia has always been very high up on my list, specifically Absolutely. Melbourne. I have some family there. And, if I didn't end up in China, I think I would have probably gone there. So to question four, how would you describe your early years in London in three words?
In three words, exploring, open mindset. Maybe that's one word if you can. And just have fun. I think you explore what is around you, go and explore work-wise, go and explore the city itself, go and understand the history of the city, because it's very important if you're a Londoner. You need to know what London is all about. You need to feel what London is all about. And have an open mindset, because anything can happen any day in this town, in the city. I've faced that. Every day has been different in a way. and have fun. There's so much to do in London, so much to explore. There's so much to go with regards to entertainment hotspots, food and hospitality. So you got to have fun. Otherwise, you're not a Londoner, I would say.
Yeah, that's so true. And I feel sometimes that point is easier for people who are not originally from London and come to London. And so they have this kind of comparative framework. It's easier for them to understand your point. And question five, if you could have dinner with someone, either dead or alive, who would that be?
I would probably take someone alive. And it's difficult. I actually like, or I rather, I would say, I'm very inspired by someone like Barack Obama. I feel his life is a great example to a lot of people, because a lot of questions that you've been asking me, I'm sure he must have gone through it as well when he started his journey in life. He's come from a migrant background. He's come from, and I really admire him as a politician. I really admire him as an individual. And he's a very motivating person, a very inspiring person for a lot of people. So is his wife. I think both Barack and Michelle are very inspiring people. And if ever given an opportunity to, you know, sit down and speak to someone to get a lot of inspiration in life, I would say I would speak to someone like Barack Obama.
I really love that answer, because it's something that I've been asked about already. But if I vision where I would love this, the direction for this podcast to go, and the type of personality that I would want on here, Barack Obama was first on that list, you know, especially because of his background story and where he got to.
Absolutely. He's a very, very inspiring person.
Yeah.
He's a very inspiring person. And I think so is his wife. I think both him and his wife are two people, I think, in our generation, who are very, very inspiring with regards to what they have achieved, from where they have come. And there are many more people, don't get me wrong. There are many other famous celebrities, and there are many other famous politicians out there. But I think someone like them, I don't think we ever expected that they would be as prominent in our society in today's world. So, yeah, Barack Obama.
Well, if either Barack or Michelle are listening, or anyone who knows them and has contact to them, then please let them know that I am always ready and would love them to be on a guest no matter what time of day it is.
Fingers crossed, one day.
Yes, exactly. So fingers crossed for sure. And the final bonus question that I ask all of my guests is, what does the term immigrant represent for you?
It's a very difficult question, I think, amongst all your questions. I would say if somebody says me as an immigrant, I would say I'm proud to be an immigrant. I represent my culture. I represent my background. I represent who I am as an Indian. Strangely enough, India and England are playing a test series at the moment. And my family or my friends sometimes ask me, whom are you supporting? I says, India, hands down. And how many ever years I have spent in this country, I will always be an Indian first. And I will always be an immigrant first. And I'm proud of the fact that I'm an immigrant to England. So yeah, be proud of who you are. And be proud of your roots, be proud of your background. And only then you will stay authentic. If you try to become a wannabe Englishman or American or anything else, I think you've lost your roots.
What a powerful message to finish on. And I think it just rounds off this conversation really well. I really appreciate everything that you've shared, but also your insights and just the very genuine discussion we had. You know, it kind of fulfilled my expectation that I got to learn a lot about what I said, you know, being Indian ethnicity, but quite removed from that way of living. So thank you again. And
thanks,
I will for
much.
Sure be checking out the EEL community as it grows.
Thanks so much, mate.
See you. Bye.
Speak soon. Bye.
So that's going to wrap up the episode, guys. I really hope you found this conversation as insightful as I did. And if there are any specific quotes or messages that really resonated with you from Joydeep's journey, then do share these with others so they can do the same. I've got some more incredible guests lined up, and I really am not just saying that. So keep a lookout for the new guest episodes, which drop as usual every Tuesday. Until next time, thanks for tuning in, and keep adding more greatness to your own journey.